You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more. Hello and welcome to the show. Today I am talking to Greg Jenner. What's he doing on the show? He's not a comedian, I hear you cry. Well, maybe not, but he has been a huge part and continues to be a key part of Horrible Histories, which is one of the funniest programs available for children. Every element of that show, every word, every sketch has gone through him. He also hosts You're Dead to Me, which is a BBC podcast that I've been lucky to guest on several times. And it's very, very funny, not pitting anyone against anything, really, but including a comedian and a historian, with Greg facilitating. And he also has written some very funny books, including Dead Famous, which is a history of celebrity. He regards himself as a student of this podcast. He's a big fan of the show, and it seemed like a really sensible thing to do, to get him on and find out what makes him tick, and find out we did. There is some stuff in the later part of this show which I will sort of add a nebulous trigger warning to. I always feel trigger warnings are a bit like spoilers. But if you are the sort of person who has things about which you are sensitive and occasionally listen to trigger warnings, particularly those to do with mental health and how we treat ourselves, then consider yourselves duly trigger warned, content warned. I prefer content warning, content warned in a sort of nebulous, spoiler free way. Does that make sense? Is that respectful enough of someone sharing of their personal sort of innermost thoughts if I refer to them as spoilers? I just want you, it takes a bit of a turn later on, because Greg is very open about some pretty deep-seated stuff he has been struggling with for his whole life, or certainly from his adolescence, in the realm of anxiety, and a real extreme type of anxiety and some very, very difficult insomnia. We will get into that in more detail later on. So what I'm saying is, he may not be a comedian per se. He's certainly comedy adjacent. And this is, I'm sure you will agree once you've heard it, an absolute gold standard edition of ComCom, even though our guest is not specifically a comedian. That's where I'm going with that. There is some great insiders content available to you, 30 minutes worth at comedianscomedian.com/insiders if you're on the private feed and in the gang. Thank you to everyone who's joined recently, and apologies that we had to reschedule the Fern Brady insiders only Zoom Q&A. That's now on the 7th of June, alongside the psychologist Amanda Donnett will be joining us for some self-help for comedians later that night. So 7th of June, you've got till then to join up to the Insiders Club if you would like to be part of those, or hear them, or have access to the audio of those later. But the stuff with Greg, we are going to talk more about his anxiety, and particularly those anxieties that accrete around social media and listener feedback, the joy of online kindness, and we're going to learn the hidden link between Rattus Rattus from Horrible Histories and Greg himself. Those are all the extras. On this show, we're going to talk about Greg's creative process in constructing analogies that package and frame his research, learn about the pitfalls of generalizing and some embarrassing mistakes he's made along the way, as we talk about the responsibility of the historian. And as I said, we are going to get stuck into some deeply personal stuff with him later on. If this is your first Comedians Comedian podcast, because you come here because you're a fan of Greg, then thank you for joining us. And this is what we do here, although we normally do it with people who are out and out comedians. So if it's your first time, welcome. If you're a returning hero, then thanks for returning. This is Greg Jenner. Hey, Greg, welcome to the show. You're not a comedian. What are you doing here?
Yeah, I'm one of those cuckoos that's arrived in the nest and has stolen the attention of the mother cuckoo. And I don't know
this
how cuckoos do it.
This is not your specialist subject, mate. Why are we doing biology?
My dad knows about birds, and I'm like, that's an analogy that'll work. It's like, no, that's not worked at all, straight off the bat. Yes, hello, I am an imposter here to invade your nice show.
Great. And you are comedy adjacent. Like you're funny. You write funny things, but funniness isn't the main thing. Almost everyone else that's been on the show, mm-hmm. And I've had a few non-comedians, but for them, a lot of them, comedy has kind of been the main thing. But for you, obviously, history is the main thing.
Yeah.
But comedy flavored history, right?
Yes, it's history, but it's been dipped in silly. I suppose the way that my comedian friends describe me, which is both nice and also something of an insult, is they say you're funny for a historian, which I think is like a way.
Well, you told me that. I remember we'd spoken about that, and the way you phrased it at the time, I think, was that you said it's a lovely compliment and also a knife in my heart. So let's start. That's a good place for a com to start. Why is it a knife in your heart? Presumably because you aren't a comic. Like you've stood on a stage before doing comedy, have you? Did you do like a sketch show or something? Give us your comedy background and then we will all judge.
Fine. All right. Okay. So for those many people listening who are like, who's this guy? People will not know me probably, but they will know the shows I've worked on. Hopefully is Horrible Histories is the most obvious one, where I'm the historical advisor and one of the writers. I've done that for 13 years. And I write sort of funny-ish history books for grown-ups and now also for kids. And I host You're Dead to Me, a comedy history podcast for the BBC, which you have been a guest on 3 times.
Current quiz, post-show quiz leaderboard, I
mean, you are currently our chief nerd, sort of, you know, I think Kay Kurd is coming for you. He's very ambitious.
Oh, is
about
he
it.
Really? Yeah, okay, fine. I fear him. That's fine.
And Desiree's very, very skilled at the quizzes as well. But yes, you are currently leaderboard champion. And I also host a kid show for BBC called Homeschool History during the pandemic. Yeah. And my background is I am a historian who adores comedy. Like, I just think about comedy most of the time, I guess. And my instincts are towards the joke at most occasions. And I grew up adoring comedy. And yeah, I wrote sort of funny stuff at university. I did a little bit of improv comedy at university, wrote sort of silly sketches for other people to be in. And I have been on stage a few times. And when I do book talks or when I do public talks, there are jokes in them. They are not necessarily as good as the jokes that you would do or your, you know, many of the guests you've had on the show. But when people come to see me talk about the past, they're going to get maybe 15 jokes in an hour that are decent enough for them to go, ha, 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 that's interesting.
Okay.
So that's what I do, basically. I'm not as funny as a comedian, but historians think I'm hilarious.
Yes, that's great, right? And why would you? Because I suppose part of my line of thinking is like, why aren't you a comedian? Because I know you are obsessed with comedy. I remember you wrote your MA on Monty Python.
Yeah, well remembered. Yeah, Monty Python's Holy Grail and Arthurian cinema. Yeah. And my PhD would have been on medieval comedy as well. I couldn't afford it, but that would have been my thesis would have been 13th century romance literature and humour and satire and Chaucer and stuff like that. So yeah, I love jokes in a sort of very highbrow nerdy way.
Okay. And does part of you, is there a sort of an alternate multiverse timeline where there's a Greg Jenner who is a stand-up?
That's a good question.
Like this isn't like, I'm not like, say, hey, prove yourself or anything like that. I'm just interested because you are, you know, you're super into comedy. You're obviously an excellent historian to the extent by which I could classify a historian. I mean, I was looking at your, I've been noodling around your website for a bit, and the reading list alone for books that you read in the creation of your book, Dead Famous, which is the history of celebrity. And celebrity, we might get onto this, has only been around, the concept's only been around since the 1700s.
Yep.
I looked at the reading list, I was like, I haven't read that many books in my life, let alone for one thing. So let's assume that for the purposes of this podcast, you are without doubt the best historian I've ever met. So, but let's talk about that timeline thing. What is that? Is there a version of you that went into comedy instead? Because you're kind of flitting around it like a moth round a candle, right?
Yeah, and bashing into it like a moth and then bouncing off
and
going, ow!
Like a moth. Yeah,
exactly. Catching on flames. And then I think the answer is probably no. I think because my sudden arrival into broadcasting and being the kind of public face of chatting about history or whatever is very recent, very late. And the reason I didn't do that before is because I was cripplingly shy and had way massive anxiety issues about being in front of people and public speaking and all of that sort of stuff. And so I think comedy would have been literally the death of me. I think I would have died of a heart attack if I'd tried. And indeed, the first time I got on a stage was, well, I was in a band when I was in my teens. So, you know, I used to be a singer in a band, but I was sort of okay with that, weirdly. But the first time I got on stage to be funny was a Josie Long charity event in like 2013, maybe 2014, called Arts Emergency. And the organizer, Josie and the organizer, Griff, had been like, we're going to book you as a basically a placeholder until we get someone better. And I was like, all right, fine.
Classic Josie, huge bitch, famously.
I think it was Neil Griff who said it, but I think it was Griff who said it. But I think that's how they like got me into saying yes. And then no one else got booked. And suddenly I was like, shit, am I doing this thing then? They're like, yeah, we've printed up the posters. You know, you're on the bill. And I suddenly had to do 12 minutes at the Hackney Empire. And I was like, well, no, that's not, what? Hang on, that's not how it starts. You're going to start with an open mic night and you do 5 minutes in front of your friends when you're hammered drunk and whatever. And that was so terrifying that I have no recollection of it. I literally have.
Really?
I can remember coming out. I remember forgetting my own name. I said, hi, I'm here. That was my opening line. I remember doing a sort of stupid, lame joke to try and reset audience expectations of saying, don't worry, I've never heard of me either, but my mum thinks I'm great. And then I don't remember anything else except right at the end, I improvised a joke and it got a big laugh and it was the best I've ever felt in my life. And
yes!
And that's all I remember of the whole thing. And it was like being blackout drunk. And to this day, I can't recall anything I said on this. I've got the script of what I said, and people who were there said it went fine. And it's like, okay, good. But like, I could, for all I know, it was sort of Manchurian Candidate style. Like my brain stopped working and something else kicked in, but I can't recall it. And so that anxiety was so intense leading up to that 3-4 weeks of terrifying sort of shivers and chills and fear that I think my body just shut down and I got on stage and went, I have to do this for the charity, but as soon as I get off stage, my brain will erase any memory of it. And since then,
is that the whole of your comedy experience? Because that is a wonderful microcosm of the experience of being a comedian. I'm
right.
So thrilled for you that you improvised a joke at the end and got a big laugh, because that's like, mwah, it's like narratively, wow, yeah.
Yeah, I think that probably to the extent that comedians would say that to my comedy career, because I've since then, obviously, I've become a public historian and I have done 200 events around the country where you get up in front of X number of people and you try and explain the history of something or other. And you're using jokes to try and make that history enticeable and enjoyable and so you don't bore people. And I did the Hay Festival in 2015 and that was 1,100 people in their sort of massive tent thing. And I went on after a Holocaust survivor and you sort of go, oh, well, that's quite a lot of pressure. And it went really well. And I think that was a moment of going, right, okay. So if I prep really hard for stuff and I know my jokes and I know my material and I've checked all the tech and I know the iPad's going to, I've got a backup. And if everything is prepped, when I get on a stage, I can be a functioning human who can talk to people. And thereafter, I've got better at it. And now I'm a lot more comfortable getting on stage in front of people and you know, podcasting is fun for me, but I am a massive sort of over-preparer in advance. As you are too, I understand from listening to your, you know, interviews you've done with other people, I know that you like to sort of make sure you've done all the research, you've got all the thoughts.
I talk loudly about all the research I do, but I basically, what I do is I prove it all up top. I've got, here's everything I've read,
right,
and
yeah,
then I kind of wing it from then. But I have similar fears, certainly, about, I do research by the standard of a podcast host.
Sure,
I do a lot of research.
You know your stuff.
But I think, certainly on stage as a performer, I'm much happier. Like, maybe it's a way that I've learned to deal with it by just jumping in and sort of free falling. So those events that you're talking about there, kind of 200 plus events, the stakes are obviously different there in terms of comedy terms, because in terms of comedy expectations. So you have the freedom to be lighthearted and invoke chuckles because you're simply talking about your specialist subject in a genial way.
Yeah. And the expectations are that worst case scenario is I'm a bit boring, but people have come to see a historian. So, you know, it's not yeah. like...
Their threshold, presumably.
Literally. Yeah. I mean, they've come in. And the reason my career has sort of done quite well since then, I suppose, is that I perhaps exceed expectations to the state that I am quite funny. And that's and people are like, he made me laugh six times, which for a comedian is a dreadful night. And you're probably thinking, God, what went wrong? But for me, is that's success, because I'm measuring something different, which is that my job is to impart knowledge in a way that hopefully people carry that home with them and remember it, and it inspires them to read books or to come back next time. Whereas your job, of course, is not to impart knowledge per se. Your job is to amuse and entertain and delight and surprise and thrill, and sometimes to make people reflect. But I'm actually trying to deliver something that I want to remember.
That's really interesting, because one of my questions is going to be, what do you see your job as being? Now, obviously, you've got a big portfolio career between podcasting and writing and the Horrible History stuff and all, you know. But that's a really interesting kind of starting point, really. The idea being you want people to remember the stuff. Because I'm sort of thinking, like, when I sit down to write a show or a joke or a bit or what have you, I'm mining my own observations, my own experience. When you assemble a book, naturally, from the perspective of a historian, you are mining resource material. Like, if you have an idea, that's bad, because you don't, like, we don't want to hear. Is that how it feel? Like, I'm just sort of interested in, like, if you have an idea, you'd better be able to back it up with a reading list.
That's it. Yeah.
Because we're not here to see your original ideas. We're here for you to display your research in an original way. Am I understanding that right? Does it feel right?
So that's an interesting, you've trodden on quite an interesting, landmine within the kind of historical discourse, in the what I call myself is I'm a public historian, which is that my entire, you know, everything I do is geared towards how do I make sure that the people I'm talking to are getting something out of this and that they are enjoying it and learning and being inspired and will come back. And so I don't really teach much. You know, I do a little bit of teaching in a couple of universities, but not really. I'm not an academic. And I don't really do original scholarship per se, because mostly my career is trying to essentially repackage other people's very clever, very brilliant, brainy, but quite intimidating scholarship into a cheerful, bite-sized morsel of deliciousness that ordinary people can kind of go, well, look, history's terrifying. I hated it at school, but you seem nice because you've got a sort of stupid grin on and I've seen you on the telly. So I'll give you an hour of my time. And if I can get them to chuckle a few times and if I can get them to think that actually history's okay, then they might come back next time or read a book. So that's my whole ambition. So I'm not trying to introduce new ideas that are my own most of the time. I'm trying to communicate other people's ideas, historians' ideas, with the backup stuff, with the knowledge. But part of being a historian is that you do need to be original from time to time in order to say something new. And so my History of Celebrity book took me 4 years, full time. It's the hardest thing I've ever done. And that's me making a really quite bold and arguably quite ambitious case of arguing quite a lot of historians are wrong, and that they've got their dates wrong, and that actually celebrity is older than they say, and here's why, and yada, yada, yada. Now, obviously, I'm building on other people's research, I'm building other people's ideas. Of course, none of this is, like, totally original, but that was the first time in my career, aged 38, I guess that book came out, or 37, when it came out, where I actually went, and this is what I think. So that was quite a scary moment, too, because that was the first time I felt like a comedian in the
sort of... I was going to say, there's a parallel there, because you have... It's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah.
But particularly in terms of their expectation, particularly in terms of the potential response. Mm-hmm. One of the big fears for any new comedian, and perhaps any experienced comedian, is being heckled.
Yeah.
Certainly when you're new or when you've never done it, the idea of a heckler. Did you have similar feelings about the possibility of having angry historians say, Jenna's full of bullshit and I can prove it? Do you mean that you get...
100%. The thing that's so different about comedy and history, of course, is that you workshop your jokes, your material, through exposure to the audience. So I'm assuming you build a show by going out, testing some stuff, you've got some notes, you've had some thoughts, there's some funny stuff you're working on, but you haven't quite landed on the phraseology, or you haven't quite found the hook, or the order's wrong. So you go out and you've got an audience there and they've got their beer and they sort of chuckle along and you kind of go, that needs work, but that's got some potential. We don't get that, historians. We work in isolation on our own for years and years and years, and we write this massive thing 120,000 words, it's dead famous, and then we publish it. And then you sort of go, is it shit or is it good? Yeah. And you have to wait for people to tell you. And it's just it's a very anxiety inducing way to live a life. I don't recommend it because there is no feedback model. There's no way to go out with it and go, I've been working on these ideas and I'm not sure if they're good. What do you reckon? The best we can do is I send my books to my sort of historian friends and various guests who I know, have been on my podcast, who are specialists in very specific areas. And I say to them, this bit, is that legit? Or have I missed something? And they might write back and go, no, that's broadly true, but you need to tweak this and that's not right. And sometimes they come back and go, no, don't do that.
Can you give us an example of what it is?
Oh, yeah. A couple of examples. So one of the really interesting ones, and I'll be open and honest here. Yeah, I try and write with sort of a sense of humor, a bit of flair, a bit of kind of joy to it and whatever. And so sometimes you're trying to sort of make things a bit fun and silly and a bit saucy and a bit sort of tabloidy almost. And I sent my book off to my friend, Professor Kate Williams, who's a fantastic historian, and I've co-presented a show with her, so I know her really well. And she wrote back and went, it's a great book, really love it, fascinating, but you write about women differently to men in the adjectives you're using to describe them. You're making women sound saucy and sexy and whatever, and the blokes less so. And it was a really good observation because I wasn't doing it on purpose, but I had internalized the way that other people wrote about them. So I was just mirroring the way in which historians and writers have described these 18th century women as sort of, using their bodies or being sexy or being saucy and glamorous. And I sort of was carrying on that tradition. And Kate was like, but if you're doing that, you're still sort of part of that loop and you're not necessarily. Yeah. So that was a really good fix where you go, oh yeah, okay, absolutely fair. And then on my new book that will be out in the autumn, it's called Ask a Historian, where I'm answering questions from the public. Someone, actually my agent, funnily enough, I only discovered this later on, asked me, what are the origins of the modern borders of Africa? Which is an enormous question, absolutely vast question. And I set about trying to answer it and did my best and wrote an answer. And I sent it off to a professor who's a specialist in the history of modern Africa. And she very kindly wrote back and went, no, this is hugely outdated and we don't think this anymore and you need to rewrite the entire thing. And that was that was really interesting because it was one of those moments of realization that I'm way out of the academic sort of conversation on this particular part of the world and this particular part of history. And I'm a sort of generalist. I don't have a specialism. And on that one, I got it way wrong. And I'm really glad I checked in with her because I got to rewrite it and do a better job. But yeah, that was like it's not even like there's some errors here. It's like the entire thing. Just no.
Jeez. And there are so many things at play there. One of which, I guess, is, as you say, you're a generalist.
My name is Greg Jenner. And I,
as you say, you are a generalist. But also, you were saying before, your journey is to kind of not just to simplify, but to package, to frame things, like, I imagine there are creative leaps for you where you go, oh, I can draw an analogy here between two things. And the analogy is yours and your own creation. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, particularly with, take that example of how you were writing about women, if you are making necessary shortcuts, because obviously at one end of the spectrum is simply cutting and pasting the contents of that book, the contents of that, you can't do that. The job is read a thing, boil it down, interpret it. Then you have to be very careful about yourself as the mouthpiece, as the interpreter of that information.
Because the framing I put on things is my responsibility, and my job obviously is to communicate the complexity of the information, the accuracy of it. Can we trust it? What are the sources? Do we think this is true or do we think this is, debatable? And then also to guide the readers through. And, writing on the history of celebrity, for example, there are sections in that book. It's a book that's hopefully amusing to read. There are sections where I'm trying to make you chuckle, but there's sections also that deal with rape, sexual assault, violence, horrific racism, and the way in which celebrity lives can be destroyed, in the most appalling ways. And you can't be doing comedy about that. You can't be doing jokes about that. So also just the sort of the tonal gear shift, which you sort of, which I guess we're seeing a lot more of in comedy. I guess we're seeing that a huge amount more in you know, Hannah Gadsby in that phenomenal show where she rewrote the rules of stand-up on stage by doing really fantastically funny jokes for the first section and then suddenly going, and now this is what the show's really about. And because you'd been so invested in the first half, the second half landed even more powerfully. And yeah, sometimes being a historian is about going, okay, we're not doing jokes in this page because this page is the Holocaust, or this page is, you know, something horrific that happened to a woman in 1912. So it's about kind of reading the room and trying to guide the reader through, because I use humor as a technique. You know, people quite often don't take me seriously as a historian, which I think is understandable because I look like an idiot and I act like an idiot and I spend most of my time on Twitter doing stupid jokes. But I take history extremely seriously, which is why I'm funny about it. For me, comedy isn't the antithesis of depth or nuance or complexity. Comedy is an aid to that. Comedy is a device. It's a technique. It's a rhetorical mechanism for delivering the complicated and the difficult and the abstract and the foreign and the, you know, stuff that doesn't make sense to us anymore. You know, if you're trying to explain, you know, we did a podcast together about ancient Roman medicine and the way in which they understood the body as a mechanism of, the blood and the atoms and what's going on in the body. And, you know, you were getting your head around it live. You know, we fired this stuff at you and you were kind of processing and going, oh, it's a bit like this, it's a bit like that. That's exactly it. It's, you're trying to find ways of conceptualizing something so remote that we've moved beyond. How do you make that funny? What analogies can you use? And I think you mentioned analogy already. A huge amount of what I do is analogy construction. A lot of horrible histories, a lot of my podcasts, a lot of my writing is using metaphor and analogy to frame things in a certain way. So the information is the kind of raw material, and then the framework is a sort of modern comparison that people can get their heads around. So, you know, we do that all the time on Horrible Histories. It's really effective, particularly for kids.
Yes, yes. Well, there's two things. I want to come back to that, kids, and we're talking about tonal gear shifts and what's acceptable and what isn't acceptable in kids, which I'm sure you've spoken about before in terms of Horrible Histories. Before we get onto that, just on the idea of constructing analogies, because I think that is a big similarity between you and a more stand-up kind of comic writer. I have a friend and colleague. Mm. Her name's Amanda. She's a clinical psychologist.
Oh, wow.
And we talk in terms of, like, her field is to do with motherhood and to do with, I can't remember the word for it, I'm embarrassed to say, but it's to do with kind of postnatal, not just postnatal depression, but postnatal kind of bonding and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And she gives lectures, she gives speeches on that. And she and I have this shared language of bits. Of like, she's got a particularly good bit about compassionate self-care, mm-hmm. likening it to an aqualung rather than caring for your child and then bobbing up above the water and breathing, which is your self-care, and then going back down. You know, when you're compassionately self-caring, you have an air supply whilst you're down there in the thick of it. And so we have this shared language of bits. So do you have... Could you share with us a bit that you are particularly proud of? Do you know what I mean? Or an analogy that you're like, I coined that one 10 years ago. And that really is what it's like, you know, just daft as anything. But, you know, I'd be interested to know some things of yours that you go, this is one of my bits that I'm...
That's an interesting point, because I think now you've said it, my brain has gone blank.
That's fine.
No, but I mean, there's probably a few things. You know, I think one of the most important, I think, points that I try and make frequently with people is that there's this innate sense that history is a kind of chronological pattern of things getting better, and that the further away you go, the more basic they are and sort of nasty, brutish and short. And one of the most obvious counters to that illogical argument really is that you go back to Bronze Age Pakistan and the Harappan civilization, and they had phenomenally sophisticated plumbing and toilets and water infrastructure that wasn't matched anywhere in the world until the 1870s, and this is 4,000 years ago. So Bronze Age Pakistan, if you got in a time machine and you needed a wee, or you were really thirsty, the best, safest place you could go anywhere prior to 1870 was Bronze Age Pakistan. So, and people are like, what? And you go, yeah. And so the analogy I tried to use at the time was, you've got to think of life, you know, you've got to think of sort of human human civilizational development and so on, is not as a straight line and not as an upward slope, but actually more as one of those horrific roller coasters that makes you feel sick, because there are those moments where they climb and it's steady and it's slow and it's gradual and you're like, oh, we're getting better, oh shit, it's sort of, yes, down the hill, and then you loop the loop, and those loops are the revolutions, and then the kind of corkscrews are the horrific famines and wars that sort of shake everyone through, and then you sort of emerge out and you go, shit, and it feels like you're back to the beginning again. And that's sort of history to a T, is that there's no such thing as progress. There's just constant change or constant. And the two of them are what make human experience so confusing and so difficult, because we so struggle to make sense of our pasts, because we're so desperate to cling to this idea of linear betterness. You know, the idea that this Whiggish notion, we call it, of things getting better as society gets more sophisticated and governments get more progressive and people get innately more kind. And it's just not true, but it can be if you want to think of it like a roller coaster. There are sections where things are going uphill, and then there are sections where they're going downhill, and there are sections. So that's sort of a bit that I usually do that's a bit funnier than that, but it's me sort of trying to explain that there isn't a simple way to look at the past. And then, yeah, there are jokes I've got that I know are sort of, they just work. So in 1793, in the French Revolution, they changed the calendar and they brought in decimal time, because they wanted a sort of scientific enlightenment philosophy, new approach to, you know, they were like, screw this old stuff. We are French. We are enlightenment philosophers. We've got the clever ways of doing these things. I'm half French. I can do this terribly offensive accent. And they brought in the idea of the 10-hour day and 10 days in a week and all of that, and 10 months in a year. And it was absolute chaos. And so they abandoned it after 18 months. Or was it 13 months? No one knew. That's the joke. You know, and the punchline is that no one even knows what the time is. And so you kind of get like this, you can get jokes out of that sort of thing, of the confusion. And then, yeah, in the 19th century or the 18th century, there was a job you could do called a knocker-upper. And a knocker-upper was someone who went along in the urban streets of factory towns in, you know, northern England, whatever, with a long pole, and they banged on the windows to wake up the workmen to go to work, or the women as well, to go to work at 5 a.m. to go start their shift. And the knocker-upper had the pole. They knocked you up with the pole. Ironically, the knocker-upper needed to be woken up. Who did that job? The knocker-upper's knocker-upper. And at some point, that person probably got pregnant, and they were the knocked up knocker uppers knocker upper, and then at some point they maybe played cricket and they were knocking up as they were, and you can just sort of keep going with this recursive sort of ludicrous, and it depends, you know, if the audience is going with it or not, but there are little bits I've got that just people sort of chuckle at and you kind of go, oh, that's quite nice. But as a general rule, a lot of stuff I do is just framing things in a way that allows people to get their head around it really quick. And the jokes aren't good quality, fantastic jokes. They just warm people up to an idea. You know, my threshold is lower than yours. Your jokes have to be better than mine, because your jokes have to deliver big laughs.
Because there's nothing else. Like, I'm not warming them up for anything apart from itself.
No, but it's not. But also, your craft is about maximum out. You know, that's what you're aiming for, isn't it? You're aiming for a kind of joyous, you're hoping that people are so tired from laughing that by the end of the gig, their face is hurt. And, you know, that's the dream. But also you're building in rhythms, you're building in flows, you're doing callbacks, you're using all sorts of tricks and techniques. Whereas I use callbacks, I use those sort of techniques. But most of the time, the thing that matters to me is, did this go in? Have you learnt this? Have you remembered this so that when you go home, you can tell your kids or your partner, or you can put it on Facebook and go, oh, today I learned that the idea of the 60-minute hour wasn't invented until 1371. And people are like, what? And you go, yeah, the hours were 45 minutes before then, or 75 minutes, depending on the month.
So this is Greg. As you can tell, I'm having a whale of a time talking to him. What an extraordinarily nice, warm and kind man. And I mean, you can tell, history-wise, I'm wildly out of my depth. So it's really fascinating to have someone on the show who is so learned and particularly learned about something about which I am not remotely learned. We're going to hear more from Greg shortly. A reminder, go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders. You can get hold of not only half an hour of extra stuff there about the difference between facts and factoids, and Greg's doomed quest to rid the internet of viral fake facts. Loads of stuff there, and plus some lovely sort of secret, juicy extra content about the precise role of Rattus Rattus in Horrible Histories and who, if anyone, that character represents, as well as the Insiders Q&As that we've been doing on Zoom. We've had Nish Kumar, James Acaster, Alfie Brown recently, Fern Brady coming up, as I said, on the 7th of June, along with a special Self-Help for Comedians episode with Amanda Donnett, which I absolutely cannot wait for. ComediansComedian.com/insiders to join up and avail yourself of all that extra stuff whilst supporting this show. And remember, you can join from a minimum of £2 a month on a sliding scale up to as much as you want, but everyone gets the same stuff. Values, he cried. Hashtag values. And I always, anytime I say a hashtag, I always just want to go, hashtag RuPaul's Drag Race, because that's the only hashtag I bother with. So before we get back into this episode with Greg, if you're hearing this in the first couple of days of it released, I'm doing an actual live gig. It's going to be my first one back. I've been doing, you know, drive-throughs and car parks and all sorts under circus tents last year. This is a real one, and it's at Trowbridge, 6 p.m. this Sunday, which I'm going to just double-check the date of this Sunday. It'll be something like the 28th. It's the 30th, so what do I know? It's the Sunday, the 30th of May at Trowbridge. You can get tickets for it at Trowbridge Town Hall. So you can just basically Google me. I'll pin a tweet on it and at ComComPod. Basically Google me. Who does he think he is? Listen, I'm addressing a very small number of you who are in Trowbridge or near Trowbridge and are free at 6 p.m. I think at 7:30 afterwards, there's a lineup show with a fantastic lineup. Mark Oliver, I believe, is on as well. It's a work in progress. It's unfinished, and I will be doing my usual flappy thing, but I absolutely cannot wait. There's a few tickets still available, so come along to that. Right, here's more from Greg Jenner. Why is that aspect of people remembering it so important? And that sounds like a stupid question, but I think what I mean is, if there is a sort of a there and then in the moment, oh, I've learned a thing, I'm excited and invigorated to learn more. Like, that's an end in itself.
Mm-hmm.
Partly this is me thinking, if you tested me again on any of the quizzes at the end of the episodes of You're Dead to Me, I'd probably not do very well. So I'm in awe of someone who has a memory like yours and who has a kind of, I mean, the listener won't see this, but it's probably about 150 books in shot, and you've shown me around the room on your webcam, and there's another 1,000. So to have access to information and recall of information, obviously part of what you want to do is, like you said, sort of boil down an idea, package it in a useful and surprising and maybe fun or funny way, such that they remember it.
Mm-hmm.
What is the value of that to you? How important is the memory bit? Like, would it be worth doing it how crestfallen would you be if then you tested someone again and they went, nah, it's all gone?
So now you've said that, I really want to get you back on the show just to see how much is stuck, and let's separate you and Kay Curd with a proper, you know, give it 3 months and then we go, right, okay.
I would genuinely be hopeless. And it, of course, that's to my detriment. That's just how my mind works. I often find myself giving up. If I see a bunch of dates, mm-hmm. I often, you know, in a bit of text, I often won't really pay too much attention to them because I know from horrible experience that that's not how my mind works. They mm-hmm. won't stay in there. So if I had realized at school that the things I will remember throughout the whole of my life are jokes, mm-hmm. if I could have got my history revision or chemistry revision and turned it into jokes, it would have gone in forever. Because there's just something about...
Yeah, but that's why we do Horrible Histories.
That's why you do it, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, the you know, the neurology of Horrible Histories, the kind of the brain science of it is that two things that people remember most are terrifying things and funny things, or you know, or very, very intense emotional things.
And sexy things, but that's
sexy
a whole other
thing.
That's a whole
too,
other
but we,
show
we can't
and the
do
BBC
that with kids.
Won't go near it.
Sexy histories. So what we do on Horrible Histories is we're trying to find, obviously you're trying to amuse kids, you're hoping they're going to have a nice time. But from my point of view, the hope is that the information lodges as a sort of, as a little nugget that will stay with them forever. Because it happened to me. The reason I'm a historian is because I fell in love with history when I was a teenager because of comedy shows.
Which ones?
Maid Marian and Her Merry Men. So the Tony Robinson feminist sort of reinterpretation, where Robin Hood is an absolute idiot and Marian is the brains of the operation. Python, obviously Holy Grail and Life of Brian particularly, but also just all the sketches. I basically owe about 60% of my personality to Eddie Izzard. So Eddie is just a phenomenal godlike presence in my teenage brain. Peter Cook, Dudley Moore, you know, I kind of grew up on quite a lot of classic stuff, sort of my dad's generation stuff as well. And so a lot of what we're doing in Horrible Histories is repeating that sort of joy I found when I was 14, 13, whatever. Blackadder 2, of course. But in terms of your point about memory and recall and the ability for people to then remember stuff, I'm not necessarily trying to build a kind of, a show or a talk that produces a lifelong recall of a thing. I think the general attitude is that if you can get people to, firstly, if they can understand something alien, then that's just great. They've moved from a conception of their own world to someone else's world. And that is a good thing in society, full stop. That's compassion, that's empathy, that's opening up your mind to other perspectives regardless. It just so happens the person you're talking about has been dead for 600 years. But if you can get them to think like a Roman, then they maybe can think like a Palestinian or like, you know, or you know, someone else, or a Syrian or a refugee. And so it can introduce ideas beyond our own. The second thing, of course, is I'm a historian, so the job is to get people to hopefully remember some history, or at least to take history seriously, or at least open their lives up to it a bit and find time for it, to keep reading, keep thinking, keep listening, keep learning, because the past is massively fascinating in its own right. I study the past because I love it and it's fascinating. It also, of course, can help us understand the present and can help us guide towards the future. Like, you know, if you don't know your history, you will make the same mistakes, but there's also that's too simplified, because you can't just learn from the past, because modernity is different. You know, we are different. But if you are aware of the history of things, then it starts to undercut argument. You know, this thing when I did the Hackney Empire thing for Josie, this terrifying show where I blacked out. The thing I did was I got up on stage, and it was the month where the Gay Marriage Act was being debated. And of course it went through, which was great. But I got up on stage and I said, there's no such thing as traditional marriage. And I made a sort of 12-minute argument, hopefully with some jokes. I wasn't there, but maybe there were some jokes. I'm told there were some jokes about the history of marriage and how completely arbitrary it's been throughout the ages, in ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, and in the Middle Ages. The fact that people didn't wear white wedding dresses until the 19th century, that you didn't get married in the church until the 1750s, like all of this stuff. To undercut the fact that there's no defensible reason why gay people can't get married. You know, that was the purpose of it. So I was using history essentially as a lever to try and change people's minds about the rights of gay people in society. So in that point, I was sort of wielding it as ammunition in an argument, really. Mm-hmm. So I guess in some ways that makes me quite similar to a comedian, I guess. So I'm thinking of someone like Sarah Pascoe, or, you know, some of the sort of big, clever, brainy comedians who want to do something with their shows that is more than just gags, but is also about who are we and what should society be. Or Josie, you know, with her, you know, those shows she's done, which are so beautifully constructed, but also have something bigger in them than just jokes.
Is there a circuit of historians who speak, and do you have, in the same way as there's like the pantheon of comedy greats and the people who you're like, let's go and see them, I won't bother seeing that person, your mum tells you, oh, I've got a ticket for so-and-so, and you're like, yeah, have you? Do you know what I mean? Is there a similar sort of thing going on in history whereby people disagree with each other's takes on things?
Oh, yeah, of course. And there are thousands of historians. I think one of the amusing things about historians is that the public sort of don't know that many of us exist, that there's, you know, if you go out to the street and sort of grab someone and say, name 10 historians, they probably kind of go, Mary Beard, Lucy Worsley, Simon Sharma. You know, I think quite quickly, I don't think many people know many historians, whereas I know 2,000 historians, probably. Like, I've talked to them, you know, so like, it, there's a lot of us around the world. And yeah, of course, there's absolutely people who are experts in things and people who have slightly controversial views, and there's internal debates and, you know, historian. The collective noun for a group of historians is an argument of historians, of historians. So, you know, you've got a murder of crows, a pride of lions, and an argument of historians. So that sort of tells you a bit about what we're like when we get together. But I think there's an incredibly strong kind of collegiate vibe amongst the historians that I know on Twitter, particularly, of a kind of mutually reinforcing and talking to each other and listening and getting on, you know, helping each other out, which is really, really wonderful. And I've seen that in comedy too. You know, I know lots of comedians personally and hang out with them a lot, and I see them talking to each other all the time and giving each other advice and do you want to drive to this gig and all that kind of stuff. It's really lovely. And the really, really interesting thing about You're Dead to Me is how similar comedians are to historians, and no one expects it. No one anticipates that, because outwardly, you and I are very different, right?
Because sure, you're a nerd. I ride a motorbike off the back of a cliff. Yeah.
Yeah. You're a danger man, and you can say anything, and society values your truth, man. Whereas I'm...
Oh, you've seen my Ackman.
Whereas I'm a sort of boffin in a tweed jacket who... but actually... The thing I enjoy the most about You're Dead to Me, without fail, is that moment quite early in an episode where the comedian goes, I'm enjoying this, in a sort of surprise. Like, I hope that you enjoyed your experience on the show. Obviously, we loved having you on, but there's a sort of, I can see it in the eyes where the comedian goes, okay, I took this as a gig. You know, it's a paid gig and I'm on the radio and whatever, but actually, I want to know more now. Actually, keep talking. And there's a moment where the historian goes, I was worried about this because I thought I was going to be made to look silly, but actually this comedian's very clever and has asked a very good perceptive question. And it's a bit like teaching master's students, and actually this is going to go fine. And that's really, really nice, that moment, because I can often see it coming, and I can see the moment where they both go, oh yeah, okay, let's have a chat about this. And it's great.
And it's interesting with regard to that, your position, as you were saying on that show, is you're the sort of facilitator. You're a kind of warm, genial host that can join the dots between the worlds of comedy and history. And perfect place for you, really. I think if I was in your position, I might be thinking to myself, I wanted to be the sort of star celebrity historian, and now I'm being a sort of connective tissue, genial host type historian. Right. Is there anything in that? I don't know if I've even asked the question the right way, but I know when I looked on your website and it said public historian, I thought wrongly, as it turns out, that was a means of not saying celebrity historian, because I guess that's a thing, right? Being a celebrity historian, you think of the big, you know, there are, in the same way as comedy, there are jobbing people, and then there are breakthrough people, and there are, oh, I've got my own distribution network and I'm doing it my way. And then, you know, there's the BBC is a huge thing. If you can get in with them, that can, you know, and then there are right up to glittering, fly around the world, huge amounts of money for public engagements historians, right? So it's a similar, strata of historians. So what are your feelings about your place within it? When you were sort of in your late 20s, were you thinking, hang on, I've got something here, I could be mega famous? And are you comfortable with how sort of successful and connected and all those things that you are? Eight questions in one. Pick one and go from there.
I had suicidal depression in my late 20s and had a breakdown. So I was very kind of sad and broken and lost and in serious danger, and had to just stop and get help and change some stuff in my life. And that's when I was like, right, okay, TV... You know, I was working in the TV industry at the time, and Horrible Histories had done 5 series of it. So I needed to sort of change it up. And I was like, right, what's a better quality of life? What's something I've always wanted to do, but what gives me more control and more, you know, a little bit less being at the beck and call of other people's needs and the kind of the enormous pressure of a huge TV show where I'm the kind of, you know, I was the central cog on this vast kids cult TV show that became you know, it was made for kids, but it ended up as this massive, massive hit where we won comedy awards for grown-ups.
It was like a crazy breakout. Oh my God, this thing is going to employ everyone for 15 years and launch all these careers.
Exactly that. And absolutely every single sketch and song went through me. Absolutely not a single word could go into that show without me checking it. And so it took over my life. Every single day of my life was Horrible Histories. And so I had a breakdown, lots of other stuff going on in my life, personal stuff that I won't go into, but I was a very unhappy, very sort of lost man, and I just had to reset. And the reset point was at 29, and I sort of had 6 months of counselling and took half a year off, and then was like, right, I'm going to write books, I think. I'm going to write books because I think I can write, and I've got stuff to say, but I think I've got a style that might be interesting, but I don't want to be the face of anything. I don't want to be the guy who has to say this stuff. And so it was that sort of weird moment of like, okay, well, can I do it pseudonymously? Can I have a pen name? And I was like, I'll do it with my name on it, but I'll just write books and it'll be fine. And they won't sell that many and I'll be okay, but I can pay the bills. And then it sort of went better than expected, to be honest. And then stuff started happening. It was like, oh, well, that would be fun to do. And I'd like that, you know, that'd be nice. And it'd be nice to earn a bit more money. And I've had, you know, huge ups and downs with finances over the years. And I got to the point, I suppose, where I didn't want to be a star. I definitely don't want to be a celebrity. I can't think of anything worse. You know, I think I don't read it because I find the whole idea of it quite strange and alien and a bit scary. But I think I have a Wikipedia page that someone has done for me. Mm-hmm. And I think it describes me as a celebrity historian, which I do not like, makes me feel very uncomfortable. And I sort of laugh about it in public, but privately it genuinely makes me feel a bit sick. And my argument is always like, no, not a celebrity historian of celebrity. I wrote a book about the history of celebrity, but I'm not a celebrity. Please don't treat me that way. Because I know what that life's like. It's horrific. I'd hate to be famous. And being on You're Dead to Me is huge fun. I'm massively proud of it. Obviously, it's sort of my baby. I kind of, you know, created most of it and worked with Ian McIntosh, and I've got a fantastic co-writer, Emma. And, you know, we've got a really close-knit team and we get fantastic people on, but it's basically my show. I can decide what we're doing and book all the guests and everything. But I do sort of hate the fact that it's my face on it, if that makes sense. And I would, if there was a way for it to be my show and to have the control and me still host it, but it somehow not be me, I think I would like that. You know, if I still got paid and the work was still as good and I still got to work the people I love and I still got to make the show and enjoy it, but it somehow was like an avatar that looked like someone else, I would definitely do that because I have long-standing self-esteem issues and the stuff that got me in trouble in my 20s that are still there. And I kind of, you know, mostly got over them, but I really don't like being the face of a thing and being.
And when you say the face, you don't mean the figurehead, you mean the literal your face being attached to the thing such that people recognize you in the street.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, so I recently did a series for Audible about the history of sitting down, which is a very niche subject that people are like, really?
It's not niche at all. I've heard all of it. It's brilliant. And we'll talk about it. But yes,
thank you.
Fine.
It's very kind. Yeah, yeah. But again, the artwork, they were like, you know, and what, you know, any thoughts on the artwork? And I was like, anything but me. And it's, I was on television for the first time. I'd done some sort of news stuff. I'd been on the news. You know, when they discovered Richard III, I went on the news to talk to Hugh Edwards about that and stuff like that. So I've been on TV a little bit. But the first time I was on television properly was for this BBC Two Tudor history quiz for Christmas on Christmas Eve. And it was weirdly, it was a quiz show where all the people on it were not comedians, but were historians, professional historians, like proper historians. And it was really scary because our reputations were at stake, because all the questions were about history, and if we get it wrong, we look like fucking idiots, you know. This is our job, right? And watching myself on TV made me physically sick, so much so it ruined my Christmas, because it was Christmas Eve, my family came over to watch it, you know, they were very proud of me, and I sat in the corner hunched up, tummy sort of like knotted up in a horrific ball, and spent the entire Christmas Day and Boxing Day just sort of dry heaving out of anxiety. And I just hate seeing myself on screen. I hate what I look like, and I hate my body, and I hate my kind of face, and I hate my, the voice I've got. And it just makes me go, ah, God, who's that idiot? And that is a very strange, it's a very strange emotion to carry around for someone whose job is being a public historian, where I literally have to get up in front of people and talk. And so radio suits me really well, because it's my voice, it's my ideas, but it's not my physicality. And telly is something I'd like to do more of now that I'm feeling a bit more confident in my abilities as a communicator. But it still makes me go, do I look like that? Wow, okay, yeah, that's weird. That's a strange man. And those feelings are better, but they're not gone. So when you say the star or the celebrity or famous, you know, I can't think of anything worse.
Thank you, Greg, for sharing that. Thank you. That is obviously that's sort of fascinating, not what I'd expected at all. And that idea of the show's really great, I do the show is great because of the way you're dead to me is your baby, your idea, and you said, you know, other people have had input of sorts. But what's great about it, and it's like incredibly successful, and it's one of the things where people who don't see me who don't encounter me as a comic in my life go, you were on You're Dead to Me. You know, it's one of those kind of things. I love it. It's really satisfying. It's brilliant because of you, and it's your idea and everything. But that idea that you wish there was a version of it where it could be you but not you is fascinating. I wonder how many comics there are that feel that way, because that's such a surprise, and everything is social media. I see now Twitter, of course, Twitter, not Instagram, because it's your words. It's like the radio of social media, isn't it? You don't need to be sort of visible.
Yes, it's the radio of social media is a nice way of putting it. Yeah, I'm better now. I'm 38, and there comes a point where you have to just get over yourself a bit, but I mean,
that to me sounds like the voice of an internal critic rather than an actual point of view that we should rebroadcast.
Sure,
I mean,
that's...
Yeah.
I mean,
you can get help and change at any time of your life, as you well know.
I got help in my late 20s, and it really, really, really helped me and saved my life, to be honest. And
Can I ask what kind of flavour of help you got? Pull the ripcord on this at any point.
No, that's fine.
Done CBT. I've got loads out of Gestalt psychotherapy. I'm doing kind of talking therapy now, and that's revelatory. I've got a post-amble cooking up for when I'm... If I can prove to myself that I still feel this way a couple of months down the line, I've got a hell of a post-amble for everyone. But my thing, as you know, is like, I'll have therapy and then immediately talk about it. And that's not healthy either. But what kind of flavour of help did you find particularly?
Yeah, I had CBT and had a great counsellor. She's German. I won't say obviously her name or whatever, but like there was a certain joy to her pronouncements coming in a slightly thick German Bavarian accent. It just sort of made
there's a lot of
sound.
Logic and rules to CBT, so I can imagine that working.
Maybe. Or maybe it was a sort of sub Freudian thing in my head of like, oh yes, good quality Central European.
this is worth it.
but also she was very funny, and I think she found me sort of quite amusing in some ways, I think, because I sort of turned up going, help me, I'm in trouble, and I've had an absolute disaster, and it's awful, and I very nearly threw myself into a train, and then quite quickly was sort of making jokes and going, I'm ready to be helped. I arrived fully like, I need help, please help me, I will do the homework, I'm very eager and keen that way, and I'm a good swotty kind of grammar school boy who will, you tell me what to do, and I will get out there and I will do it. So I made progress real fast because I think I knew I needed help and I wanted help and I wanted to get better and I wanted to be good for my partner and for me and for my family, and so I could get back to being a functioning human again. But there were things she said that I just had never occurred to me that were very straightforward, and there were things that she said that were important that I still don't know if they're entirely right, but every time I think about them I go, well yeah, that could be a thing, I suppose. And I'm a strange fish, I suppose, in a lot of ways. Like I'm a teetotaler, I have been since 19. I a chronic insomniac, better now in my 30s, although I've got a toddler, so the sleeplessness is not my choice anymore. Man. That's yeah. But from the age of 14 to the age of 29, I was a devastatingly bad sleeper to the point of, yeah, like mental illness from that, and would often be 4 or 5 days without sleep. And at the same time would be a high functioning historian on a major TV show. Like it's kind of weird to go back, but one of the strangest things that I explain to people about what it's like to be an insomniac is that I say to people, I'm 38 years old, but I've been awake for 41 years.
Great bit, Greg. That's very funny. I'm too deeply into your journey at the minute to really give that the respect it deserves. Great bit.
Because I've been awake as much as someone who's been alive 41 years, because I've spent 3 years in bed staring at the ceiling going, well, I should be asleep now. This is not good. And what happens when you're an insomniac, and I don't want to generalize, but for me, what happens when I'm an insomniac is everything I've ever thought about or learned or want to learn or any creative thought just thunders around my brain like a kind of pinball. And so I spent most of my 20s composing symphonies in my head and writing songs and listing every king and queen of England backwards and naming every film I'd ever seen and just sort of obsessively ordering and reordering and creating and critiquing stuff in my brain just over and over and over and over and over. And it's just exhausting, to be honest. And so it makes me a very good historian because I have a very good knowledge of stuff because I've spent a lot of my life sort of reminding myself and reordering and rethinking and every book I've read has sort of gone in there and then gets reordered. And in my teens, I learned kind of mind palace techniques for memory, you know, the memory techniques of the mind palace. I learned those and I found those quite handy. And so I was up in my head. I spent my whole life in my head. But I didn't tell anyone. I was just like this. I was this very cheerful, smiley, silly man who everyone sort of assumed was fine. And I think I was probably quite fun to be around. I think I was probably quite a nice, good friend to have and chatty around the office and always sort of giggling and being silly. And then, you know, one night stood on the train platform and thought, might throw myself under this train, actually. So I was just like neurologically broken and culturally just could not bring myself to get help. I couldn't sort of get out of the guilt spiral and the pain spiral and the confusion spiral. And also exhaustion makes you irrational. The more tired you are, so you can't think straight anymore. You just get into these loops of eternally being so tired that the only decision you can make is the worst decision because you haven't got the kind of mental strength to make the right one. So what's curious to me, and you've mentioned memory before, Stu, and obviously, I'm a historian. I'm fascinated by memory. What's really interesting to me is how unreliable I am as a witness to my own life. I have massive gaps in my memories from my 20s because my brain was fried and I was there, but I wasn't present. I was sort of like the Keith Richards of the history community, but not in a fun, glamorous way. In a kind of I just have holes in my recollections and I can't remember where I was for things and the order of them and stuff. So it's weird. I've on the one hand, I've got a really good memory for facts and dates and names and historical stuff. And on the other hand, my autobiographical memory is very poor. And it's quite shocking sometimes, but it's also been quite helpful occasionally because it means that I don't really remember the grief that well. I don't remember the pain that well. I look back on my 20s and I know I was miserable, but I don't feel miserable, weirdly, because I think I fried the circuits. So I feel like a kind of 1980s movie robot, like a Johnny Five come alive, where I like, you know, the electrics have been frazzled and you reboot me and I'm like, hello.
That is extraordinary, Greg. I didn't know any of this. Now I know why you like ComCom so much. that's absolutely extraordinary, and that perspective on the idea of you lying in bed. I was always going to ask, and then I thought that would be trite to suggest that maybe that was of benefit to you as a historian. I mean, benefit's totally the wrong word, but no, to go through the kings and queens of England forwards and backwards whilst trying to get to fucking sleep, like to kind of have a mind palace, to have so much time? Like, we talked about the number of books you read. Were you able to read when you were insomniac, or would it all be kind of internal pinging around your own head?
And that's part of the, part of the problem with trying to be, I was trying to be in a functioning relationship with my partner, who I've been with for 17 years, and she needs her sleep. So she'd go to bed, we'd go to bed together, and I would have to lie in the dark. And this is before podcasts. This is before radio would stop at midnight. Like, there was nothing to listen to. Like, there was nothing to do with my brain other than lie in the dark and think about all the worst things I'd done, all the worst mistakes I'd make, but actually not so much that most of the time. Most of the time it was just information ordering and creation and, you know, songwriting or writing a play in my head or a book in my head what would be a good name for a movie? I know, I'll list through 300 possible options for a good name for a movie, you know, stuff like that. And I would look at the clock and go, oh, it's 2 a.m. now. So if I get some sleep now, I'll be fine. And then it'll be 3 a.m. Well, if I get some sleep now, I'll be fine. If I get some sleep at 4 a.m., I'll be fine. As long as it's not 7 a.m. and it's 7 a.m. You go, oh, all right, well, it's work. Back to work, go to bed that next night. And the way that insomnia works for me is it's cumulative. So one bad night equals a minimum of 3 bad nights. So it's not like you have one bad night and then the next night you recuperate.
You catch up, yeah.
I'd have 3 bad nights in a row and then I would be knackered on day 4 and hysterical sometimes. The funniest version of me, I think, as a kind of losing my mind sort of version, I guess, was on a historical drama shoot. So the drama for Channel 4 back in 2008, I think it was, about 1066. So, you know, the Bayeux Tapestry, You're Dead to Me, whatever, that's another link back to that. But yeah, I was up a hill in Yorkshire. We were filming the Battle of Hastings. And I was the assistant producer and quite a senior role, and was showing 2 journalists from the Times around the set and introducing them to the producer and the director and, you know, whatever, to kind of do a puff piece for the Times about our drama coming out on Channel 4. And I had not slept for 5 days and I was just giggling hysterically at a bottle of ketchup that found to be the funniest thing I'd ever seen. And it had a little label on it that said "Stay Clean Cap," presumably a cap that doesn't get mucky with ketchup. I found that the funniest thing I'd ever read. I thought it was the funniest thing I've ever seen. I thought it was people imploring their cap to stay clean and not give in to corruption. And in my head, I had like this Line of Duty style, like soap opera going on about this ketchup bottle that's being tempted by bribes and people going, "Stay clean, Cap, stay clean." And all the while, the journalists are sort of going, "Okay, and so when does the drama air?" And I'm like, "Oh, the drama airs in August." But meanwhile, my brain's going, "Stay clean, Cap, stay clean." So
was this all was that kind of, like, do you still suffer from insomnia now to that extent?
No, I'm a lot better, a lot better. Thank God. I think I was lucky. I think to a certain extent therapy helped a bit. I think hitting my 30s seemed to help a bit. Like, physiologically my body seemed to just change a bit. Commuting less helped massively. I was commuting 3 hours a day every day to London, and obviously working around the clock and working 7 days a week and on this huge show. So that really helped. Getting back into exercise and playing football was really important to me because I hadn't played any sport in my 20s. And just a bit more, I guess, security. The job, you know, I got a book deal. The money was quite good. I was in a loving relationship and we managed to rebuild after some tough times. And it was, I guess, just a lot of stuff got right again, I think. And yeah, from time to time I'll have a bad night. If I've got to wake up in the morning at like 7 a.m. for a thing, I won't sleep that night. My brain won't let me, which is annoying. So whenever the BBC are like, "Could you do an interview with Andrew Marr at 7:30 in the morning?" I'll be like, "No," because actually what you'll get is either a very, very tired man who says something stupid on live radio, or someone who just sleeps through it and misses it completely. So you don't want to book me for the early... any interviews after 10 is great, but I can't do early stuff.
If there was a carefully, sort of a deftly constructed version of a book tour, which mm-hmm. was kind of a stand-up show,
yeah,
but in an artful kind of way, would you be interested in doing a tour?
Yeah, I think so. And when Dead Famous came out, which is a history of celebrity culture from 1700 to 1950, and it's focusing on 125 celebrities, and it's sort of funny and light, but it's a very heavy work of scholarly history, but it's dressed up with jokes. But one of the characters in the book is a guy called Edmund Kean, who I love. and he was a Shakespearean actor 200 years ago, and he was the most toxic bellend you possibly could imagine. The worst, awful, awful man, but a genius, genius actor. And I just desperately want to root for him, even though he's the worst. And he would have hurt me if I was his friend. He's terrible. And I did a sort of, you know, the pandemic came, launched, pandemics don't launch, do they? The pandemic dropped a week after my, it's sort of basically my book came out 4 days before the pandemic. So I was devastated that 4 years of work was just sort of interrupted. And of course, you immediately go, oh, you know what, it doesn't matter because what matters is people's lives. And of course you do. But for the first week, I was like, oh, fuck, like the timing is so bad. But the character of Edmund Kean, I did do a kind of stand-up set about him was sort of 15 minutes long, whatever, and deliberately had jokes and whatever. And it did make me go, oh, this is fun. This is nice. Like a live audience in front and I'm doing jokes and I'm sort of defending him and I've got callback jokes. And it's like, maybe I could try this somewhere else longer. But it's just the anxiety of, and also I don't have the technique. I don't have the technique of handling a room, of the callbacks, of the hecklers, of the what happens if it goes wrong. I'm not trained.
You could sort all that in a week of theory with a director and your first five shows.
Maybe, but I, you know, it's that
because your audience, you're not playing the Belfast Empire.
Well, that's it.
You're not doing
Glasgow on a Friday night.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know,
I know.
You're doing
I know.
Your audience, and it's anyway. Listen, I'm going to stop trying to convince you to do something else, but I think that'd be great.
I may be one day, but I think you know the analogy I would make is that I like you know I'm super into football, and Premier League footballers are phenomenally good at football, and non-league footballers are really good at football. And the weird thing about that is you'd imagine non-league footballers are crap at football, but they're not. They're really good at football. What they lack is the extra 5% of elite, world-class intelligence, positional play, understanding, discipline, athleticism, flexibility, fluidity, the ability to read what's going to happen next. Like the little extra thing is what is the massive difference between earning 500 quid a week playing for some village in Liverpool and playing in the Champions League. And I am a non-league comedian in that I am competent at constructing a joke and probably can deliver it and people will go, yeah, that's all right. But I'm miles away from the big leagues.
We're not leaving it there. we're not finishing on that excess dose of humility. Louise Lee says, time management, how? I think Louise's question here is, you get an incredible amount done.
Yeah, and not sensibly. So, you know, the first thing to say is I'm very privileged to have a wonderful wife who is looking after me and cooking the meals and mostly cares for our daughter. And she goes to her grandparents and to the childminder. So, you know, I don't have to do a huge amount of childcare, which is so hard for so many at the moment. But yeah, in lockdown, I've managed to write 2 books and co-write 50 podcast episodes. So that's about 450,000 words. And that is a lot, obviously. You know, I'm not going to dress it up and say like, oh, you know, it's easy to do. It wasn't. It's a huge amount of work. But to do that, I worked 7 days a week, 14 hours a day for 8 months. So I went to bed at 3 a.m. every night. I woke up at 9:30. I had breakfast and I went back to work. And I just did that for 8 months. So, you know, I take breaks in the day. I'd, you know, take my daughter for a walk. I'd have lunch with my wife. We'd watch a sitcom. We'd chill out. We, you know, little moments, go for a walk of trying to like get the brain. But in truth, all I did was work during lockdown. And that helped actually distracted me from the terror of lockdown of the plague. But yeah, I think I'm very blessed and very lucky to be privileged to be someone who's a high functioning concentrator. If that's a word, that's probably not a word, is it? But like I can sit still for 15 hours and forget to have 3 meals and just be busy working. That's no problem for me. And I can read a book in an afternoon, no problem. And I can write pretty fast. And you know, I'm hugely self-critical of my writing. So I rewrite and rewrite and rewrite and rewrite. So the writing is easy. Rewriting takes ages. That's my big problem. Letting go of a thing and saying this is good enough now for people to see it, that takes a long time. So I don't have any good advice because I think all of my functional practices are terrible for other people to emulate. Because
I think Louise might have been hoping for the name of an app or something. But
shit, right? Yeah. What I'd recommend actually is
14-hour days and sitting still and forgetting your meals. But thank you. That great answer. We're just going to do some super quick ones. Aidan McCaffrey, who's the best king or queen?
Depends what you want to measure.
What do you want to measure? Who's your best one?
Well, what's best? What is best? I mean, who's the best comedian, Stu Goldsmith?
It is, I'm going to say, what's the guy's name? Aaron Chen today.
Hey, nice. What do we measure? I mean, you have to measure all sorts of different things. And of course, you can go around the world. We have a very strong European focus here. So we tend to kind of go, oh, it's probably Henry II. But you kind of go, there were other kings in other countries. But as a general rule, you have to measure competency and you have to measure economy. You have to measure ethical things like, you know, did they kill loads of people to achieve their goals? That sort of thing.
And how acceptable was that at the time?
At the time and now in hindsight and how, you know, and so, you know, as a general rule, when people ask me this question, which they ask very frequently, I often, as a kind of dick move, will kind of go, oh, Henry VII, because he is super important in establishing what the Tudors become. And in a lot of ways, where he starts and where he finishes is a phenomenal, like, you know, he starts as a nobody, but as a sort of minor aristocrat, and he ends up as, you know, and so
Henry VII. Exciting narrative arc. That's good. Yeah, that's part of the,
that's so, sort of Henry VII. But he was kind of mean and he wasn't great and you wouldn't want to sort of hang out with him. So, you know, whatever. But I think what's interesting about that question is people always ask it. And I always want to say, why kings and queens? Why are we so interested in the powerful and the rich and the famous and the glorious and those who wield power? Why not? Who is the greatest ever?
Who is the best peasant?
Who is the best peasant? Peasant of the
best
year.
Peasant and, of all time.
And the award goes to Gerald. Well done, Gerald. Thanks very much. But isn't that fascinating, the idea of measuring best versus worst or you know, it's so hard. You can't really put people on a sliding scale of competency. It's just, you've just got to go, they did this stuff and that's what the impact was and this is how they're remembered and... So, yeah.
Thank you. That was a great question. You and I have got very different ideas about what constitutes a dick move. Sandra Hayes says, who does he think has been hard done by in the history books apart from all women ever?
apart from half the population of the planet.
So let's go. Most hard done by individual in terms of their actual deeds compared to how they are remembered.
Oh, that's hard. That's very, very difficult.
It's a good question. I should have emailed you that in advance.
Yeah, exactly. It's tricky. I mean, I'm trying to think. There are kings who have terrible reputations, and yet, and I'm back on kings, aren't I? But I think that the truth is that quite often it's that we don't really understand necessarily the complexities of the time and the era. And so I'm not going to give you an individual because I think that's unfair. I think what you have to remember is that people get judged by what matters at the time. And then in hindsight, you can look back and go, that probably wasn't so important, actually. And maybe there's other things we can evaluate and measure. So, you know, there are prime ministers, I think, who at the time were kind of laughing stocks and jokes. And then you look back and go, but quite a lot of stuff happened in their reign that was, or in their tenure that was sort of important, actually. So, you know, so I'm not going to give you an answer because, frankly, as soon as I say it, I will regret it. And then I'll email you a week later going, can you please cut that, Stu? Because that's not the right answer. So all I'm going to say is that, yes, women have often been underlooked, misunderstood. And it's really important that as historians, we're also now increasingly looking at the history of disability, the history of race, the history of gender, the history of sexuality, the history of poverty and of... and a lack of access to things and to see how that changes the way we view the world, because so much of what we think about the past is the story of the powerful enacting what they want and then justifying it afterwards. And so historians are often now going, but hang on, these people over here were doing something really interesting and they got forgotten and it sort of withered away, but actually their ideas filtered into something bigger. And I guess you can see the same in comedy. I'm sure there were great acts in the 70s and early 80s who didn't become household names, but they were the ones who inspired the era-defining pioneers that came through in the alternative scene or who ended up with the big Saturday night TV shows. So, history's full of those underdogs and historians are trying to make them overdogs. Shit, that's not good.
No time to rewrite now. Final question. This is mine. I often ask people what they want from their comedy careers going forward, like round off the interview with a projecting forward idea. From you, not about you, not about your career, But given the knowledge you have of the past, and earlier we spoke about kind of optimism and the feeling, the theory that things continue to get better, what do you, as a very learned guy based on a very learned guy about history, what do you anticipate from the future? And I suppose what I mean is, have we got a chance? have we got a chance?
Oh, okay, so the thing that's making me... So a few years ago, I was on Do the Right Thing, the comedy show,
yes.
And someone said to me, what's next? And I jokingly said, pandemic. So ever since then, I've been getting tweets and people listening to that old episode going, holy shit, Greg Jenner knew. And I was like, oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. But yeah, pandemics happen every 100 years. It's just a sort of horrible thing. There are things that just recur. And of course, the main devastating thing that's coming will be climate change. And we have to... But I don't know. I think we're living through a fascinating moment. And the past 5 years, just 2016 to 2021 alone, has been so earth-shatteringly different and rule-breaking in so many ways, in political, moral economy, in terms of the rules, in terms of which party stands for what. Like, the Tories are suddenly the party of big money handouts to everyone. You're like, what? How has that happened? Everything has been radically broken and is now starting to be sort of put back together a little bit, and all of the accepted norms are being challenged. And I think that's going to be really interesting for comedy. I think it's going to be really interesting for culture. But I'm absolutely bemused and baffled as to what it means for our society going forward and who we become and how we pay the bills, because I don't think we've got a great parallel analogy that we can borrow from the past. I think we're heading off into uncharted waters, and the planet's getting hotter all the time. So it's not to end on a downbeat end, because there's great people on this planet doing fascinating, great stuff. But I don't know what's happening next. And it gives me great anxiety sometimes, and it also sometimes allows me to not sort of get stuck on the kind of like, well, I've seen this before, the kind of deja vu thing. That's, you know those guys in disaster movies, the scientist who runs in and goes, my God, Mr. President, if we don't do this now, the volcano will kill us all. And the president's like, no, it'll be fine. And then the volcano, you know, erupts. And I don't want to be that Cassandra guy, the kind of the doom monger. It's quite nice to sort of go, I don't know. So I'm trying to do more of that and be a bit more like, we'll see. And yeah, I have faith in good people. Let's put it that way. I have faith that there are enough good people out there who are going to save us. But in the meantime, I'll just do silly jokes about dead kings, and then we'll see where we get to.
Thanks, man. So that was Greg Jenner. If that has whetted your appetite, by all means, rush to comedianscomedian.com/insiders to find out another half an hour of stuff from him. I'm so, so grateful to Greg for sharing so much of his sort of inner landscape. I think that's, as he said, he sort of feels safe on this show, and I really appreciate that. I appeared on another podcast recently called Desert Island Discworld, about the work of Terry Pratchett, and the host Al Kennedy and I were chatting. We recorded this last night, comes out quite soon. I talk about the fifth elephant and why it's excellent, and why Sam Vimes is the only real character in all of literature. Fight me. But we talked about this podcast. I sort of described it to his listeners, and one of the things I think I said quite late on in that conversation, for people who hadn't really understood what it was I was talking about, I was kind of making much of the fact that, almost uniquely among comedy podcasts, I listen on this show. Maybe not in the blurbs, but certainly during the interviews. I really listen. I really try and be quiet, and I try and be invisible. And I was also at pains to point out that it was, that I hope this show is benevolent. Yes, why am I saying this? Just because I suppose I'm just really grateful to Greg for going into so much depth on some tricky areas that, as we learnt with his kind of eschewing of the concept of celebrity, and particularly seeing his face on things, you wouldn't necessarily, like, there was no need for Greg to get into that with us. And I'm really glad he did, because he's already a lovely and charming man. Is it positive? Of course it's positive. It's not just fascinating. I mean, what's the value? This is turning into a postamble now, but what is the value of hearing people share that stuff? To me, it's just, and we're all in a big sort of
wave of this happening all over the place is recognizing that everyone, not everyone, but you never know who is suffering. You never know who is suffering. You never know what anyone is putting themselves through. And I drifted through school profoundly unhappy and very, very guarded and not sort of really able to explain it or not really sure that anyone would listen or care. So in those days, there were no podcasts and there were no kind of insights really into what a successful and very ostensibly, very sort of professionally successful, visibly successful people, what they were actually feeling. So anyway, I think the point I'm saying in a extraordinarily roundabout fashion is that I'm grateful. Thank you, Greg, for sharing so much. I think it can only be a good thing that we all get to know a bit more about sort of the inside story on people who are, to all intents and purposes, the sorts of people we should ordinarily be jealous of. Is that fair? At the very least, what we've done is that perhaps the historians of tomorrow who might be thinking, you know, I'll never be anything like Greg Jenner because I've got big problems with anxiety. Oh, actually, hey, we all do. Right? Good. That was all entirely unnecessary, but there it is. Thanks, Greg. Thank you as well to you for listening. Do share this with people. One of the lovely things about appearing on You're Dead to Me is it exposes me to a much wider audience than the comedy world in which I ordinarily reside. So if you are a You're Dead to Me listener who's given this one a go, mate, there's a 372 episodes out there with your name on, so feel free to get stuck into the back catalogue. We've got stuff with Sarah Millican, with Jimmy Carr, with Patton Oswalt, with... God, I mean, literally 372 names. I'm not going to list them. No one's got time for that. Thanks for joining us. Thank you to Nathan Wood for editing and uploading the show. Thank you to Jake Crossland for logging it diligently as ever. Your podcast consultant was Pete Dobbing, and the music was by Rob Smouten. I've been Stuart Goldsmith, and you can contact me by emailing me info@comedianscomedian.com. If you're expecting a reply from me for any reason over the last few months, do check your spam filter, because it turns out info@ is an absolutely dreadful email address to have if you don't want to get caught by spam filters. You can also get in touch more publicly at ComComPod on various social medias, but I don't do a lot with Instagram these days. That is all of that. Come and see me in Trowbridge this Sunday. Tickets are available from trowbridgetownhall.com/events/Stuart-Goldsmith. If I were you, I'd just Google me and the word Trowbridge. I'm sure you'll find it. trowbridgetownhall.com this Sunday, the 30th of May at 6 p.m. Going to be a lot of fun. I better write the show. I will absolutely have time set aside on Thursday to write that show, some of which already exists and some of which simply does not exist until it happens. And that's one of the most exciting things. All of the extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And do join us if you fancy for that Fern Brady Insiders only Q&A. We're going to book another Sophie Hagen's up for one as well. So we'll get one of those in the diary before too long. Keep thinking there's something else. There is. Tell you what, instead of a postamble, I'll tell you about this. This is a thing that Lee Kyle sent me. Lee Kyle is a brilliant comedian and podcaster, and just very funny person. Just one of those people who, among comics, you're constantly sort of wrong-footed and laughing at little things he does socially. I've been on a couple of podcasts with him in the past. He has set up, here we go, a load of us, he says, have set up as a non-profit to start gigs and other stuff in the northeast of England. We've got a new thing coming out next week we want people to know about. I'm late to this. It came out on the 19th of May. It's a video on demand service called Noutflix, where every show has been donated by the acts and all the money goes back to putting more gigs on and making more shows. The site is Noutflix, Noutflix, noutflix.co.uk, and there's a bunch of shows on there. And there's a press release. Who's on it? People like Seymour Mace, we've had him. Fantastic. Lost Voice Guy, former Comedians Comedian of the Year, nothing to do with me. Gavin Webster, Viz Kingpin, Simon Donald, as well as Raoul Coley, Rachel Jackson, and a bunch of other names, some of which I know, some of which I don't. But they're all good names. Certainly those people I've mentioned, a lot of them are ComCom people, so I think you would probably, you'd do well to check that out. And it's hosted by Felt Nout, which is a community interest company set up by comedians. And I love it when comedians do things for ourselves and for each other and set things up. So go and check it out, noutflix.co.uk. And I'll chuck a tweet. I think I've already retweeted something. I'll do something like that as well. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Yes, there we go. I can't believe I'm expected to tweet a thing. Jesus. People have no concept of the value of my time. That's everything. I continue whilst hawking my own endeavours on talking to your business about resilience and authenticity and what you can learn from the comedy industry. If you want to find it, go to stuartgoldsmith.co.uk/speaking or just stuartgoldsmith.co.uk and have a little nosy around. If you're on LinkedIn, get in touch. Let's be on LinkedIn together. What a brave new world it is. Speak to you soon.